Now stay tuned for the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
Hey, good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for being here today. This is a show that I'm excited to do just because of the topic. And I hope that you'll be with us for the hour and follow along in fascination as well. Our guest today is Dr. Kristen Swenson. She's an author. She's an associate professor of religious studies at Virginia Commonwealth. She's an award-winning author. Her writings include nonfiction, fiction, screenplays. She hosts a podcast on writing. She writes a blog on cooking and environmental issues, and her most recent book is what we're going to discuss today. A most peculiar book, The Inherent Strangeness of the Bible. Dr. Swenson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Rick. I'm excited to talk with you about this project.
Well, I would think that with that title, you must have gotten many requests for conversation. One of the first things that I want to toss out there and let you know is that on Sundays from 11 a.m. to 12 noon, the traditional church time, I'm not sure how many of our airwave listeners rather than the podcast listeners are actually listening and are true, staunch believers in the Bible. So I throw that out there as we get started. And I also want you to explain the title, because it seems like it could lean in a couple of different ways in the purpose of the book.
Yeah. So I do hope those folks who might be in church right now or during the airing of this show would be willing and interested in tuning in to the podcast, because I come from a Bible-loving background. And actually, I start this book by making the confession that I love the Bible. But as I have learned more and more about it, I realize that my love for it has changed in sort of the way that love does in a long relationship. When you get to know the other with all of their different peculiarities. And in the case of the Bible, I think anyone who has read or spent much time with it has encountered its strangenesses. What's somewhat unusual is that we don't have much of an opportunity to talk about that, I think, for a couple of reasons. One, I think people think that if we discuss the ways in which the Bible might even make us uncomfortable, or the things that don't all add up when we are reading it, that we are somehow treating it disrespectfully. And I maintain exactly the opposite. I think that the Bible begs us to engage with it. Because of its strangenesses, the Bible asks that we ask questions, that we bring our full intelligence and our whole humanity to bear in relationship with it, rather than approaching it as a kind of one-way dictatorship. We just have to sit and listen, and whatever we hear is exactly the truth with a capital T. But instead, I think it asks us to lean forward and say, yeah, but what about, or, but over here. So I think the Bible's strangenesses may actually be its greatest gift.
You have a quote in the book that says that the Bible itself undermines the popular declaration, God said it, I believe it, that settles it.
Yeah, so the Bible is commonly referred to as the Word of God. So it is what God said. I think that given the Bible's strangenesses, and I'll come back to that in a minute, that the Bible asks us to allow the possibility that God continues speaking and is in conversation with those who are in conversation with it. Specifically, the Bible is full of contradictions, and people who are eager to dismiss it as irrelevant, obsolete, a bunch of nonsense, not to be taken seriously, sometimes point to those and say, yeah, but, you know, look at how many animals did Noah take on the ark? Because that particular story contradicts itself internally. But I maintain that those contradictions, which reveal the way that this Bible evolved over a long period of time, also reveal different ways of thinking about whatever it is that that particular text may be raising. And so rather than, again, taking any particular biblical text as the final story, the end statement, I think can be a kind of mistreatment. And let me back that up a little bit, because the Bible grew up over a long period of time. It is ancient, so it reflects a world and a worldview that's quite foreign to us today. It also was written in languages that are unfamiliar to most readers today, most believers. And so we're relying on translations. If you're not reading the Old Testament or the Hebrew Bible in Biblical Hebrew or the New Testament in Koine Greek, then you're reading a translation. And every translation is itself an interpretation. And so sometimes translations disagree with each other, but that's because the original, if you will, language allowed for a number of different possible translations. So I love having, I urge people to have a number of different translations in front of them so they can see the ways in which the Hebrew or the Greek may have allowed for a number of different translations. But back to the God said it, I believe that that settles it. If you are reading already in translation and you read only, say, Genesis chapter 1, you might conclude that the world was created in 7 24-hour days, and God did this as a disembodied, all-powerful, external from the earth being, speaking the world into being. That's that seven-day creation story. It's magnificent, Genesis chapter 1. But just a couple pages later, we have a God who walks around, talks with people, fashions a human being with God's hands, if you will, breathes breath into this Adam, the first human being in that story. And it's a very, very different image of God and a different, again, a different ordering of creation, human beings. And the order in which human beings and animals are created is different in those two narratives. But that doesn't mean that one is wrong at all. I think it just asks us to read them a little differently than we might read, say, a science textbook or even a history book today. The Bible asks us to think differently than we might with other modern texts. So it undermines, yeah, that absolutist declaration.
So you have mentioned that Genesis chapter 1 has two different versions of how Adam and the world were created, and that if I were to go into I was raised Methodist, if I were to go into my Methodist church and ask the minister to tell me the story, I'm going to get God created the world in 7 days, and on the seventh day, he created man. But what you're saying is that it's not that far down the pages that there's a different story about what happened. Why is it that in so many churches in today's world, we seem to read through page 2 and don't read page 3 through 6?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think there are a couple different reasons. But one, I think, is that we're accustomed to reading in a certain way, and we have expectations for books that we come by honestly. You know, we expect a book of history to report events that happened as in however they did. We expect a book that tells about the creation of the universe to tell us a kind of scientific report of that. But we get in the Bible something different than that. And I urge people to take the Bible on its own terms. So rather than reading Genesis chapter 1, which tells this story of God's creating the world in 7 days, instead of reading that like a science book or otherwise trying to force it to answer our questions about the universe's origins in a scientific way, to let it speak on its own terms as theology and poetry. And if you can learn a little more, that is some of the background behind these texts, which I urge people to do, because knowing something about the Bible makes a huge difference in being able to make sense of what's in it. That's what I worked on in the book I wrote before Bible Babble. If you learn a little more about Genesis chapter 1, for instance, you'll learn that most scholars, believe that it took shape and may have even been composed in a period of great trauma to the authors, if you will. The biblical scholarship has generally is in main agreement that this text came out of a period of Babylonian exile when the people had lost their nation and they had lost their temple. And they were forced to live in a country not their own. And they questioned whether their God really was God and really was in charge of this world. And in this chaotic experience of Babylonian exile, there were these people who would not give up on God. Some people did. Some people said, you know what, our God was defeated by the Babylonian God. That's why we're here. Or our God couldn't stand up and do what needed to be done to defend our country and the temple. But the people responsible for Genesis chapter 1, most biblical scholars believe, were people who would not give up on God. And instead, they composed this story that narrated the great power of God over not just that nation, but over the whole world. And this just is so moving to me, not only the creation of the world, but that it was good, and that it had order. The chapter itself as a literary piece, if you just evaluate it on its literary terms, you can see the ordering of the verses, the ordering of the creation with this kind of repetition and antiphonal refrain that it was good and that it was very good. And in that story, we read of the human beings created actually male and female at the very same time. And in the image of this God, who is a creator God of a good and ordered world. So if we let it stand on those terms, it can, I think, make great sense to us. But when we try to force it to be a scientific treatise on the origins of the universe, it falls apart because we know that the universe was not created. It didn't come into being in 7 days. We know this scientifically. And that's great. This story, I maintain, and I'm not alone, is rich and valuable for reasons apart from an effort to relate a kind of scientific narrative. And then, and I'm sorry, I'm going on a bit here. I love Genesis, and these first few chapters are so rich. We could spend a week talking about just these two stories, Genesis chapter one. And then in Genesis chapter two, we come to another story. That's the story we think of as the Adam and Eve story. That's the story in Eden, that particular garden, if you will, which is more like an orchard, actually, in the story, is a very different narrative. And in that, again, God is a down and dirty God who is in on the earth, has planted this orchard that God apparently wants to care for, and invites the human being to participate in the caring for that particular plot of land. Some have thought that the folks responsible for that text, which most biblical scholars think was earlier in its composition than Genesis chapter 1, may have been agrarian farmers, were really connected to this soil. The Adama is the Hebrew word out of which Adam, the human being, was fashioned. Very different stories, but they're together. So I love that. They're both in the Bible, right? So the fact that they're both together invites us to appreciate all these dimensions of God and God's relationship to the non-human natural world, our earth, and our relationship to both of those things, to the earth and to God. So it's a highly nuanced and really rich collection of evocative literature there.
We are talking with Dr. Kristen Swenson. She's an author of the book, A Most Peculiar Book, The Inherent Strangeness of the Bible. She's an associate professor of religious studies at VCU. There's so much more to try and discuss in the remaining part of the show. Let's take our first break, and we'll be back with Dr. Swenson. Hang on. And thank you for being with us today on this Sunday. Dr. Kristen Swenson with us, discussing A Most Peculiar Book, The Inherent Strangeness of the Bible. So, Dr. Swenson, let's start and by talking about some of those particular strange events. And one of the ones that kept my attention for a bit was something you say in the New Testament. I think many of us who are familiar with the Bible, or who at least went to church on a regular basis, whether we went at a younger age and whether or not we continue to go, we all know Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the first four Gospels in the New Testament. But you tell us that those are not the authors of those Gospels. Share that information with the listeners who may not know.
Sure. So there are a couple of categories of strangeness that I address in this book. One of them is that the Bible as a book is strange. It's a collection of books. You just mentioned the New Testament, which is a collection of books within the collection and is not necessarily a part of everyone's Bible. So Jews don't have a New Testament, but we share together the Old Testament for Christians, a Hebrew Bible for Jews. And it's also got a lot of strange stuff in it. Your question straddles those two things. One of the things that's strange about the Bible for us is that a lot of the book's titles don't reflect the things that we, again, expect with our modern reading eyes for them to do. So we would think that each of these Gospels is by a guy by the name of Matthew, a guy by the name of Mark, sat down and wrote this Gospel. But as with many of the books in the Bible, we don't actually know exactly the name of the individual responsible for that book. And in many cases, we can be quite confident it wasn't only one person. That is, many of the books in the Bible, and this is one of the things that is strange about the Bible, we know were the product of different influences by different folks over time. And that doesn't in any way diminish its respectability again. We might say, oh, then it's just been plagiarized, or it was, you know, cannibalized, chopped up, and only, you know, people. So how can we possibly believe this, or how can we possibly take it seriously if it doesn't tell us exactly who wrote each of these books? But that was just a tradition associated with authorship in the ancient world. Now, again, the Bible developed over a long period of time, so some of those texts, they do reflect a tradition of identifying the person who may have been responsible for it most of all with it. I'm thinking about some of the prophets, for example. Not that they necessarily sat down as individuals and wrote out those books, but we can be quite confident that there was a man by the name of Jeremiah, for instance, who was responsible for delivering a lot of the message that we read in the present book of prophecy attributed to Jeremiah. In the case of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, we don't know exactly the names of the people who were responsible for those books, but that, again, that doesn't detract from them in any way. It is just a peculiarity of the Bible. But I'm glad also that you raised that point about those four Gospels, because one of the things that, again, we tend not to really face is the fact that we have four Gospels. In other words, we have four different narratives about Jesus' life, death, and resurrection. We have four different ones. And again, I think that isn't to suggest that nobody really knew what they were writing or nobody had the real truth, but instead, on the contrary, that here are these different perspectives and different interpretations of this Jesus of Nazareth, whom the people responsible for these texts believed to be the Messiah, a Mashiach. And that belief then, and their ideas about how to communicate that, these are all called Gospels. They're called good news. In other words, they're written by people who are interested in how they're telling what they're telling. They want people to believe. So we have these four different narratives. How wonderful for us that we have four different ones. That, again, invites us to be in conversation with it rather than simply to read anything with just a flat finality or that kind of dictate that the Bible is dictating our one thing or another to us, but instead inviting us to engage with it, to debate with it, to question, to argue, maybe even to disagree at times.
Well, one of the things that you mention is not that the four Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, that they're not just the original authors, but that there was a specific reason that they were attributed to their names. You said that they were, or you say that they're attributed to them because they had clout.
That's right. So you didn't want to just, so you wanted to attach the name of somebody that people would recognize to, or that had some cachet to whatever it is that you were hoping to promote out there in the world. And these were names that had that. And so in this early, I think we can start calling it a Christian community, you know, here we are in the earliest days of the Christian tradition. And already, of course, you had these folks identified as leaders within that community. And they tended to be people who had had some kind of connection with Jesus. Not necessarily, though, that the people who wrote these books were necessarily disciples of Jesus. These books, the Gospels, were written quite a bit after Jesus' death and decades. So we would want then for these stories to be associated with people who were associated with Jesus. And again, it's not to not to diminish their import or value in any way. It was a sensible tradition when you think about it.
Dr. Kristen Swenson is an author and an associate professor of religious studies. Her book that we're discussing today is The Inherent Strangeness of the Bible. Dr. Swenson, you have another chapter that you call Oddities in the Bible. And I took two notes here that I'd like to talk about, and one subsection that you call Matter of Fact Weird. All right. So can you help us understand the matter of fact weird oddity on some of these super long lifespans that are mentioned in the Old Testament?
Yeah. So again, it's just helpful to know something about the Bible. And one of the things that we know about the Bible is that it's really, really old, and it evolved in real times and places, and in particular, the ancient Near East. We know that there was a tradition in the ancient Near East of attributing super long lifespans to really important people, and especially people who were ancient to the people who were writing whatever it was. So you have these king lists from the ancient Near East that have lifespans that are somewhat analogous to what we find there in Genesis. And they're in Genesis, I mean, it's kind of funny because you read along and there, these people's lifespans are noted without any kind of without any hiccup. You know, we read along and it's as though that's perfectly normal that someone would live hundreds and hundreds of years. And again, we get into trouble if we are approaching this text with the modern expectation that a text providing genealogy is going to be precise in the scientific ways that we would expect modern genealogies to be. But instead, it is doing something similar to the ancient Near Eastern tradition of attributing really long lifespans to people who had already lived a long time ago.
No fast food back then.
Well, some people have said that, you know, the Mediterranean diet is very healthy, but really to live for 700 years, I don't know.
Adam is listed as 930 years old and Noah at 980 years old. That's
they did well by the Mediterranean diet, but it is one of those that we're not totally sure why they have this attribution of such long lifespans, but we're pretty sure that it's related to a greater cultural tradition.
So another matter of fact, weird oddity that I made a note of in your book is the story of Jonah and the whale. So can you give us a brief story of Jonah and the whale as you might hear it in the in a current Bible, the King James Version, so to speak?
Sure. Oh, boy. I actually love this book because it's so unusual among the other books of the prophets. So this is a book that appears in the Christian Old Testament, in the Hebrew Bible. It comes to us through Hebrew. It is a little-ish book, pretty short, and is among 12 books in the greater collection of prophets that we sometimes call minor prophets, but only because they're short books, not because they're less important. Jonah is especially unusual because Jonah is a really reluctant prophet. We do have other reluctant prophets, but Jonah tries not to do the thing that God had asked him to do, which was to go and prophesy against the Assyrian capital of Nineveh, which is a very hated, reviled by Jonah's audience, these Israelites, if you will, would have despised the people of Nineveh, who were an enemy, and they were a colossal powerhouse, Assyria was. Well, Jonah is told to go and prophesy against them, and he says to himself, yeah, thanks, but no. And intends to go in exactly the opposite direction. Boy, I need to try to figure out my Cliff Notes for this because there's so many elements of it. But this is one of the things about the Bible one of my pet peeves is trying to tell the Bible story as though it should conform to the stories like we tell them today. But still, there are all these great stories. So let's get back to Jonah. Jonah is one of those. Anyway, Jonah heads the other direction. He is on a ship. God in the story creates a storm that finally forces Jonah's shipmates to throw him over. So Jonah's shipmates, one of the other things that's really cool about this story is they are not Israelites. They're foreigners to the readers of the story. And they are the most God-fearing people in the beginning of the story. Rather than Jonah, who has denied his call from God, these folks pray to God. They wish that God would calm the sea so they don't have to throw this guy overboard. But Jonah says, no, really, I think you're going to have to throw me over. So they throw Jonah, I'm totally paraphrasing, this is not in King James language, but Jonah in the story is swallowed by a great big fish. And in Hebrew, it's a fish, but because it's so big in our English translations, we call it a whale. And in the belly of the fish, Jonah exists for 3 days, and he even sings songs. He comes up with a psalm that he sings in the belly of the fish. And then he is, after 3 days, spewed up on land, and has to start over again. He starts now to go to Nineveh to prophesy against the Assyrian capital. So weird, right, that Jonah, I mean, there's so many strange things. Jonah is swallowed by a fish in which he lives for 3 days, and then after being regurgitated, suffers no ill effects from stomach acid or whatever. Once again, we should not read this as a scientific treatise or an historical reportage of facts. But another thing that's so unusual about this book, and that is so moving to me as well, is its portrayal of the foreigners. So one of the most unusual things about this book is that Jonah very reluctantly prophesies against. So he doesn't, still, even when he's there, finally at Nineveh, finally giving this prophecy, he says, 8 days until Nineveh shall be destroyed, or however many days it is. I have to look at that again. But it's a really half-hearted delivery of a warning, where other prophets go on for pages and pages and chapters pleading and begging with people to change their ways so that they could be reconciled with God. But Jonah, it's almost like he mutters it under his breath. And immediately the Ninevites repent and turn to God, if you will. They are portrayed, these horrible foreigners in the eyes of the readers, are portrayed as so pious and so they're portrayed as repenting to the last person, and not just the last person, but even the cattle, even the livestock of Nineveh put on sackcloth, which was a sign of repentance and mourning for their wicked ways. So it's it's such a rich book on so many levels. But yeah, the fish itself is a weird one.
So just a minute or two before our next break with Dr. Swenson, and we're talking about her book, The Inherent Strangeness of the Bible. But one of the things that you mention in the book is that people, and I'm going to paraphrase here, is that people today need to use their head and their compassionate heart to understand the Bible. Otherwise, it simply becomes another weapon of hatred and destruction.
Yes. Yeah, and you nailed it, Rick. I think that's exactly right. Yeah. So I advocate for lifelong learning, learning about the Bible, learning as much as you can, even about the languages. If you can't learn the languages, and that's a huge hurdle, is get a bunch of translations together and learn, read some biblical scholarship by people with credible degrees in this sort of thing, who don't have a bone to pick one way or another, but are just telling you something about the historical context out of which the books come, or their literary forms and what we should expect. So yeah, to learn. And also in other fields, and compare the science, you know, these don't have to be at odds with one another, the science and the Bible. And also, of course, to use our humanity, to be people who withhold judgment and use some compassion, recognizing that the Bible says a lot of things. And so, yes, to avoid picking it up and beating each other up with it. I applaud that restraint.
Dr. Kristen Swenson, as we're talking about her book, The Inherent Strangeness of the Bible, and she's written that for teaching and learning, not to give people text for tearing down the Bible. Stay with us for the last 20 minutes. We'll be right back. Okay, back in action, talking about A Most Peculiar Book, The Inherent Strangeness of the Bible, with the author, Dr. Kristen Swenson. She's an associate professor of religious studies at VCU, as well as a lover of the Bible. I didn't phrase that very well. It's a quote, "I love the Bible," is what you say early on in the book, and you said it earlier in the hour. Because of your faith.
And because the Bible's so weird, and its weirdnesses, its strangenesses invite us to be in this relationship with it. Yeah, I like that it challenges our expectations and asks us to think with more nuance. And we were talking before the break about using head and heart, intelligence, and also our compassion. And I think the Bible's strangenesses invite that even further. That is, they ask of us that we exercise some humility in our engagement with them.
So let's talk about a couple of the strange and weird things again. And I don't know that this falls under one of the chapters that was labeled weird or strange, but I think for many people, with Christian faith today, and not just Christian, I suppose, but the Ten Commandments cannot be found in the Bible, not as they're presented today, not in some 1 through 10, copy me onto a tablet form.
That's right. It's a very provocative declaration, because, of course, the content of what we call the Ten Commandments is in the Bible, but there is no list numbered 1 through 10, just like you said, in the Bible. I remember as a kid growing up, I grew up in the Lutheran church, and we, you know, believed the Bible, read the Bible, and based our faith on the Bible and still do, but I expected then the Bible to conform to what I believed it should do. And for instance, I remember reading nativity stories of Jesus, and I thought that the shepherds and the wise men, of course, would all appear in the same story. And I looked in vain for that story where they all appear like we have our Christian crushes, but they don't. The Ten Commandments, I also was astonished to discover that they are not laid out 1 through 10, with number one is this one, number two is that one, anywhere in the Bible. And so it makes sense that you have different faith traditions who adhere to the Ten Commandments, or who identify their being Ten Commandments, number them differently. And that's because we don't have them all in one tidy numerical form. We also have two different versions of the ones that we normally talk about as the Ten Commandments. And further sort of challenging me as a kid when I realized these things was that they're also not introduced with the words, the Ten Commandments. They are called Ten Words. But in, again, this is Hebrew. We're talking about the Old Testament or the Hebrew Bible. And the collection that we identify as the Ten Commandments commonly today are described as words, not commandments, though Hebrew has a perfectly good word for commandments. So, yeah, that can be surprising to folks, and it's especially challenging when you want to, say, set up Ten Commandments in a public place. Which ones are you going to pick, and how are you going to number them is a very real question, because there isn't one way, and the Bible doesn't lay it out.
Where did that idea come from? Did it come from a movie back in the 1920s, or where did the
Charlton Heston
come from?
Maybe?
Right. I mean, is that where did we get this idea of here are our Ten Commandments?
Well, it certainly is biblically based, because again, the content is there in both Exodus and Deuteronomy. It's just that we have applied numbers after the fact. But we do this with the Bible a lot. Actually, the chapters and verses that we have in the Bible, those are applied after the fact. Those are not original to the text. But again, this is a living document of kind of constant human engagement. And I think we treat it as a sort of dead, fixed, static object at our impoverishment. I wouldn't say necessarily peril, but at our impoverishment. When we allow it, we recognize how it has been how it grew up over a long period of time and has been used and interpreted and argued with and debated about over a long period of time, and learn some of that background scholarship, then, wow, it just gets richer and richer. I taught at Virginia Commonwealth University for many years. VCU is a secular institution, so I'm not in that classroom trying to convert anyone to any particular way of believing, any religious belief. But a lot of my students came from religious backgrounds, and many of them were concerned that when they started to learn these things, background information about the Bible, that would be problematic for their faith. And I hastened to encourage them in allowing that learning to enrich their faith. It might challenge it, but it's enriching to learn more about this text rather than to treat it as something that is immediately understandable on first blush and should be immediately applied into one's life without any kind of critical assessment or any kind of, again, background information about it. And usually it's not just applied to your own life, right? But instead it's applied, like we were talking before, to other people's lives and how it should show you how bad they are. It's the other weaponizing the Bible that can be so problematic.
You have a great quote in here, and it's applied to one particular section, but I think it goes through the entire book, is, it's crucial that what we recognize when our wishful thinking, it's crucial that we recognize when our wishful thinking, when our notions of what the Bible ought to say, complicates our reading with what's actually there.
Yeah, thanks for that. So the final chapter in the book are my 10 commandments for reading the Bible, which sounds really presumptuous, so I have to add a whole bunch of caveat at the beginning of that. But the 10th of the 10 commandments, each of which parallels one of the ways that we can number those 10 commandments, the biblical 10 commandments, is paralleling the kind of coveting commandment, not to covet your neighbor's house and wife and livestock and all that stuff, is that you have to take the Bible. Don't wish you had a different Bible than the one you have, but take this one with all of its strangenesses, peculiarities, things that might make you uncomfortable, and go from there. And again, I think that it is those things that I said it before, I think are the Bible's greatest gift to us. It's this wonderful invitation. I think the Bible demands that we engage with it, that we think for ourselves, that we ask questions, that we challenge, that we disagree sometimes with the text itself, because it disagrees with itself. So it's modeling already internally, I think, the kind of conversation that it's begging us to have with it.
So, Dr. Swenson, we're inside of our 10 minutes left, and I have a number of the oddities and inconsistencies and contradictions left to ask you about that you mentioned. So can I start throwing some out there that you give two-minute answers to? I know that's always
toss
difficult
them.
For a professor, but
toss them. I'll
so
see if
there's
I can just batter up.
You label this as a weird miracle oddity. Moses parts the Red Sea.
Okay. Yeah. Weird. We don't have any other explanation of why this happens except that God enables it so that the Israelites who had been in there, in bondage there in Egypt, could pass through, and the Egyptians chasing them would be washed into the sea. It's a grand story of God's rescuing the people. But never mind that a little earlier, it was God who had hardened Pharaoh's heart, according to the Bible. So it raises some questions, but yeah, okay. I'm ready to swing next.
All right. You mentioned this very early in the show, an inconsistency. The number of animals on Noah's Ark, where the majority of faiths are taught two of each, climb the ramp onto the Ark.
That's right. But within that same story, and tangled up within it, is two of the, well, seven pairs of some animals. And so in that story, we have a pair of every animals, or more than one pair of some animals, is reflection of the way in which that narrative is knitting a couple of different literary traditions together. That is, that story that we have in Genesis is the product of an editing combination of a couple of different literary strands that were doing different kinds of things. So one of them is concerned with sacrifice, and the animals that are considered clean for sacrifice, you would have more of. So anyway, you have some disconnect within that particular story with respect to the number of animals. But what it says to me is that the Bible its main concern isn't that we try to number exactly how many animals went on some historic boat that survived a great big flood. But instead of maybe doing something else, that miraculous survival is part of it. But there is also then this kind of weaving together of concerns about how best to do, enact the stuff of religion.
Another story that falls in the chapter of inconsistencies and contradictions is the story of David versus Goliath.
Yeah, right. In a different place than that story, we have a different warrior actually killing Goliath. But again, we know when you learn some about how the Bible, learn something about the Bible and how it came into being, we know that there were different traditions that were floating around, so to speak, that became a part of the final product that we have, and that this final product doesn't conform to our modern expectations of the way a story might be told. Or in the case of that particular story of David and Goliath, it appears in books that purport to tell history, but that history is told with a very interested theological perspective. God is a player in that history. And so you don't have the kind of history that we would read in a public school today that is reporting or trying anyway to report events as they happened in a way that we might be able to kind of double check, fact check. It's doing something else again. And I love that there are these disagreements within the Bible, or that there is this knitting together of different traditions, because that we see the seams sometimes of that. We see these, we can see evidence of two or more influences, because it shows, and again invites us to think about how things might have been, with a lens that is colored theologically and not that isn't trying to just do strict history. When we ask it to, when we demand of the Bible that conform to our expectations of a narrative, a strict historical narrative, then it falls flat. But I maintain that that the people responsible for the text that we have knew every bit what they were doing, and they made these choices intentionally. And I believe, as a person who identifies as Christian, that God, whatever, however God is involved in that as well.
Okay, we got about a little less than 3 minutes left. So, under a note I made under God, is you say that God is not omniscient.
So, back to Genesis, those first few chapters, which I love so much. So if we want to, the biblical God is not a, or there are biblical texts that undermine any declaration of God as omniscient. That is not to say that God is not omniscient. So I want to peel those things apart, because one is a statement of faith and one is an observation of how the Bible tells things. And a statement of faith may be that God is omniscient, and fair enough, that's a statement of faith. In Genesis chapter 2, we have a God who is kind of, Genesis chapter 2, verse 4b through 3, the Genesis story of creation in the Garden of Eden with Adam and Eve. You have a God who's sort of creating a little bit trial and error. God creates Adam, this human being. I say Adam instead of Adam because Hebrew doesn't distinguish between proper and common nouns, except by using sometimes a definite article, which doesn't appear on this. And so it doesn't have to be the name Adam. And Adam in Hebrew is also a general noun that means human being, and it includes women as well as just general human beings. And Adam, after the division of, or after the rib, if you will, though it's not in the Bible, a rib, taken from Adam's side, you have then, the in Hebrew, the two words ish and isha. That's when you have man and woman. Anyway, Adam, the human being, God makes fashions and then sort of says, but it's not good for the human being to be alone, God realizes, and then trots the animals out in front, but none of the animals were suitable. And so we have then this creation of Adam into two, into Ish and Isha, into man and woman. So, yeah, so the Bible doesn't necessarily, so you could say there are stories in the Bible that suggest this other element, this other side of God, but as a person of faith, you may certainly still declare that God is omniscient.
It's fascinating because our guest today, Dr. Kristen Swenson, as we talk about her latest work, A Most Peculiar Book, The Inherent Strangeness of the Bible, so many more topics that we could get into today, particular stories, thoughts and questions. You can pick up the book at your local bookstore or wherever you make your purchases. Professor, thank you so much for being here today. Fascinating conversation.
Thank you, Rick.
I've learned so much, and I hope the listeners enjoyed the hour.
I hope so, too. There's so much more to talk about, and I loved visiting with you, Rick. Thank you.
Well, we'll invite you back in the future because there's easily another hour to talk about.
Oh, boy, and then some. So much fun. Thanks, Rick.
All right. And you. All right, folks. We'll be back again next Sunday.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at cvillepodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for The Wake Up Call, only on 97.9 The Wren.